This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
The practice we'll do will be working around emotionality, emotion. And that'll be the practice because there's nowhere more so than in the realm of family and family relations that emotionality is more intense. You guys agree or no? Yeah? It's like the last frontier of spiritual growth. It's like normally, I think I'm got my shit together. And so the willingness to include family as an important part of practice is part of Dharma. And I would never say what kind of relationship we should have with our parents, with our caretakers, with our kids. I don't know what's appropriate. But I do know that whether people, the family members are alive or dead, whether we're in contact or not, family is an important theme of Dharma practice. And the whole story of our family has to take its place in the heart. That there's no way of actually running fully from that. And that the bonds of family, our parents, if we have children, brothers or sisters, the bonds are so deep that we're going to need to come to some terms with them in the heart. I'm not saying everybody has to move towards like looking like some the families on television or something, you know. But there needs to be a kind of place in the heart for all that's happened to us and all that our family is now, will be, has been. And this is going to take some effort because the level of sensitivity, that's how I feel when I'm around my parents, is that it's like the level of sensitivity is just amped up. And I feel a little, it's just the, like the emotional world, the emotional body is just, it's just closer to being like on a little trigger. It's just things of trigger, agitation and impatience and embarrassment and way faster than normal. And so I think I may have been Stephen Levine who said, you know, the reason our families push our buttons is because they installed them. And now in some ways that's not a real Dharma perspective in the sense that we need to take full responsibility for how we relate to what's arising in our minds. But we can appreciate that the self has really been formed in relationship. And that's why this idea of like that they installed them is actually there's something to it. In the sense that we become who we are in relation to. That we have the sense of being, you know, oh, I'm me. But really, the trace of our parents, of our caretakers, very much there in who we think we are. And in this way, you could say we're very deeply connected to them, even if we don't see them or they're not alive. That the legacy of our parents is living through us. And we are, in some ways, an expression of both their suffering and their potential. That you are even here at some level is an expression of our parents' potential. And so there's not going to be, there's no place where we can just cut off and just say, I'm not going to deal with themes of family. Now, this doesn't mean that our relationship, we should imagine some like every relationship has to be like this perfect reunion or something, you know. That it may be appropriate to have some very clear boundaries. But we're going to need to come to terms in our heart with where we've come from. So Thich Nhat Hanh, this is from his book on anger, actually, but he's talking about the kind of fantasy that we have or that parents can have of sort of becoming detached, of just like, I'm not going to deal with that. I'm not going to deal with my kids. And kids may have the same sense of their parents. I'm not going to deal with that. And what he's pointing to is that this is delusion. As a father or mother, you have to listen to your son or daughter. This is very important because your son is yourself. Your daughter is yourself. Your child is your continuation. The most important task for you is to restore communication between you and your child. If your heart does not function well, if your stomach's not in good health, you don't think about cutting it out and throwing it away. You can't say, you're not my heart. My heart doesn't behave like that. You're not my stomach. My stomach doesn't behave like that. This is not intelligent. You might talk to your son or daughter like that, and we could say our mother or father like that. And this is not intelligent either. The moment your son or daughter is conceived in your womb, you see yourself and the fetus as one. You may even begin to have a conversation with the baby. Keep still, my beloved one. I know you're there. You speak to him or her with love. You become aware of what you consume because whatever you eat and drink, the baby also eats and drinks. Your worries and your joy are the worries and joy of your baby. You and your baby are one. When you give birth to the baby and the umbilical cord is cut, this awareness of your unity might begin to fade. By the time your son or daughter turns 12 or 13, you've completely forgotten that she or he is you. You think of them as a separate entity. You have problems. Having a problem with your child is like having trouble with your stomach, your heart, your kidneys. If you believe that he is another person, a separate entity, you can say, go away, you're not my son. You're not my daughter. My son doesn't behave like that. My daughter doesn't behave like that. But because you cannot say this to your stomach or to your heart, you cannot say it to your son or your daughter. So this is the work we're stuck with, the work to which we, that has been entrusted to us, that as practitioners of the Dharma, this is the work that's been entrusted to us. And I don't know what this healing looks like. I don't know what development or progress looks like for each of you, or even for me exactly. But I know it's gotta be part of the path. So in working with these themes of family, there is a real place for understanding. And a lot of the psychotherapy that gets done is a way of understanding, and it can be very, very valuable. And in fact, meditation and Buddhism can bring us new understanding of our place in the family, how we react the way we do, why that is. It brings a deeper understanding of our fear around intimacy. It brings a deeper understanding of the depth of our love. But we also have to be willing to practice without really understanding. That we don't even have to know exactly what's happening to do good practice. In this sense, that my experience with family is it's like this subtle fog that comes over me. I can almost sense it. It's like everything becomes a little denser and a little hazier. And it's just like I'm in some kind of slightly altered state. It's not my ordinary consciousness. That's even when things are well. You know, it's not like that's the sign that things are bad. But I think I don't know what to make of that exactly. And I definitely don't understand it. But I just don't feel as clear. I just don't. My mind is not as sharp. And I'm way more reactive. Now, having some equanimity with that is very helpful. I don't even understand why I'm reacting the way I am or what this sense of fogginess is. I just know that something's a little different and I want to try and be aware of that confusion and that lack of clarity. It's like I can feel myself almost like get confused. And the practice of equanimity, of the heart finding its peace, doesn't need to understand its object. Like when feelings come up, the mind's tendency is like, oh, that's anger, that's fear, that's sadness. And that can be very helpful. But it's also okay to just keep the heart open and present to feelings that we don't understand. And most of the time, in emotionally intense situations, we don't really understand what's happening. So the practice is to maintain that steadiness of heart, kind of composure, even when we don't understand all the forces that are pushing on us in different ways. Is this making sense? Yeah? Now, just because these feelings are kind of vague and we don't know exactly what they are, doesn't mean they're not intense. And a lot of times, they can be a little slippery. It's like, when your knee is in pain, you really know, like, okay, my knee hurts. But this kind of discomfort is a very subtle, broad feeling that often kind of blankets the whole body. That may not make sense, but we'll explore it in meditation. And so in working with this intensity, whether we understand what's arising or we don't, is central in Buddhist practice. So Pema Chodron says, if your everyday practice is to open to all of your emotions, to all the people you meet, to all the situations you encounter without closing down, trusting that you can do that, then that will take you as far as you can go. And then we understand all the teachings that anyone has ever taught. So the clarity of mind can arise by simply staying present with the fogginess, by being present and alive with equanimity, with the okayness of the heart to the emotions that get pushed a lot during this time. And what we may find is that what pushes many of our buttons is the unwillingness to accept suffering in the ones that we love. That actually seeing the suffering of a parent or a child is a very heavy burden to hold. Just seeing that can get us very reactive. And with our parents, it may be that seeing their suffering reminds us at some deep level that they never could and cannot protect us from this world. That as we grow up, it's a very helpful illusion to have parents who find a way of creating that sense of safety, right? And they scramble, right? They scramble and scramble in order to create the sense of safety for a new child, right? And yet, they can't control much at all, that we're very vulnerable from birth, that our parents are not the protectors in the ways that we want to imagine. And for me, seeing my parents suffer reminds me in a deep way that there isn't safety in the ordinary sense of the word. And so I get reactive to it. I see that suffering and I want it to just go away. Just want them to stop doing what they're doing, whether it has something to do with me or not. I just want them to stop suffering. And I don't have children, but in being around kids and parents, seeing that parents have limited power to protect their children from suffering is a painful insight. It's painful to watch somebody that we care for suffer, that we're charged to protect suffer. And so much of our reactivity, I think, with children or parents is the sensitivity of the heart to the suffering of another. And then the question is, can that seeing of the suffering of our parents, the suffering of our children, the suffering of brothers and sisters, can that seeing actually soften us? Because it usually hardens my heart and I try and make it go away. But we're not in control of the flow of pleasure and pain, of suffering or well-being. And so during the holiday season, when we see this, when we see a child or parent or sibling suffering, can we allow that to actually soften the heart rather than retreating into the ordinary strategies of controlling it and making it go away? I think this is at the heart of a lot of reactivity. I'm not sure. But I think it's at the heart of a lot of our unskillful reactions. And perhaps it comes from this seed of wanting people to be well. That even fury, in our fury, there is a seed of wanting them to be well. So we'll do some practice. First, just acknowledging that something real deep in us wants things to be okay. And then turn more directly to the kind of emotion that if met with unconsciousness, will drive us to unskillful behavior. Any questions about what I just said? Yeah. Yeah, thank you for asking. I thank you. So if somebody didn't hear, the question was about what is meant by softening in the face of seeing the pain of others. Is that right? Yeah. Yeah, and the body, as you say, is key in that. The ordinary way of dealing with the uncomfortable sensations that arise in the face of another's suffering is to tighten down and do something to make the feelings we have go away. And we imagine that saying something, doing something, trying to shake them out of that pattern is going to do that. And the practice that I'm suggesting is really to stay present to the body without acting on the imperatives of it. The body's going to want us to do something, anything, and we stay. Softening to the intensity of that moment, and perhaps seeing that this is a moment for compassion for ourself, but also for the person who we see suffering. That if I can actually connect, you know, with my own emotional reactivity in the family situation, I can see this wish that they not suffer. It's a very, very innocent wish. This insight softens the heart. This leads to less reactivity. And so if we can say, as we process our own, the pain of our own moment, if we can say, you know, in our head, may they not suffer. May their suffering not spill onto other beings. And may I, in this moment, keep a thread to the Dharma. May I know this for what it is. And may I not spill my suffering on them. That there is, I think it's a Kabir poem, something like, we're each entrusted with our own burden of pain, and our task is to carry it well. So in that moment, can we realize the urgency of the practice? Because if we don't bring some strong intention to practice, we're going to react in the way we've reacted our entire life. And it's seeing the compassion for other, compassion for self. Does that make sense?
Grieving from it may be because I'm older than you, and I have gone through different experiences with my parents, but part of what I relate to what you're saying is kind of grieving that they will not be the parents I wanted them to be in some ways. I mean, some of what you're saying seems very compassionate and not selfish, kind of, but from the point of view of the kid inside me that reacted to my parents on every visit during the holidays, a lot of it was wishing they would be different. you know, and maybe that's what you are kind of meaning by suffering, because it's wanting to change them. But so there was partly me noticing me wanting to change them, but then there was also the softening into that there was some grief connected with that.
Yeah.
I just.
Yeah. Well, what I mean, in wanting them to be different or better parents, in some ways, that's basically the wish for them to suffer less.
Okay. I wonder if that's good.
If they suffered less, they would be more like the parents you envision.
Yeah. And then there's the other thing that either you or Noah said at the retreat, in terms of compassion, being able to be, and forgiveness, being able to see the other person's behavior is often caused by their pain or their fear.
Yeah. And you know, there are probably 20 different ways that this day could have gone, you know, because you're right. Forgiveness, compassion, kindness, renunciation, practicing with emotion. We could think of many ways, and the whole, you know, not 3 hours, but a whole entire retreat could be devoted to it. Others,
just more of an observation, because you're talking about that family fog.
I
just humble. It sounds like unwanted detachment.
Sounds like detachment. Yeah. That could be. I definitely feel like there's some buffer. So maybe detachment is a good word. I don't know. But it does. It feels like I just don't even know what to make of it. It just feels foggier. My mind just feels foggier. Yeah.
Safety,
yeah.
Safety
attachment. Yeah. Thanks.
I find that, like, I have this hard time with open-heartedness within, like, a family realm. I mean, it carries over to life as well, but it seems like the ego is pushing back towards, you know, you're constantly weighing the pros and cons of taking kind of a risk. I don't even want to call it that, but the risk of being open-hearted.
So
to me, I feel like a broken record as far as like weighing the pros and cons all the time.
Yeah.
And I know that the open-heartedness is better and will do good in the long term and in general. But for some reason, the ego just wants to go back to not being open-hearted. And that's just kind of the constant up and down for me.
Yeah.
And it seems like that happens more so with family.
Yeah. Well, I think that maybe there are times when open-heartedness doesn't mean a certain course of behavior. It doesn't mean like laying it all out there necessarily. Maybe it does. But as one of my teachers says, there's a yes of love and a no of love. We think of love as always yes, but there's actually a no of love. And our practice with our own mind is open-heartedness, for sure. But it doesn't mean that we have to take a certain course of action and always sort of think of ourselves as being on like Oprah's show or something. You know? Like if that's what love is, you know, it's like it's doing what people do on Oprah, you know. I don't know why that came into my head. But as you see that the ego, you know, and this is, we haven't even talked about self, but this is all the dance of self. And it's good to see how old roles, old ideas of who we are shaping and molding our behavior, shaping and molding how we literally see things. Yeah, one more. Yeah, Ali.
I was saying that the self has been like formed in relationship with
yeah, yeah.
the parents that we were probably installed the buttons in there at the beginning. yeah. Most of it. The de-selfing or the finding freedom. So it comes solitude, but won't you say in the same token it has to come in relationship as well?
Yeah, that...
Selfing ourselves as we find, you know, freedom from the self, the construct itself. Doesn't it come in relationship as well?
Yeah. Well, it does. Freedom emerges often out of a teacher-student relationship, out of a relationship within the Sangha. It's important to realize that we're sort of working along two registers, and one is healing the ordinary relational self, and another is seeing through that deeply. And they don't conflict. They sound like they do. I don't think they do. That we are healing the ordinary relational patterns, how we interact with people, how ethical we are, how much care and kindness we can show in very ordinary ways. Our sense of self being worthy, that these are all very important and worthy Dharma projects. But that there is a kind of limit even to the very well-adjusted self. That it creates a kind of pressure on the heart that is oppressive. And as I practice more and more, what I see a lot of is in myself and in others, I see the arising of ideas of who we are and the consequence of suffering that follows. And you just see it. It's in our faces. Our faces broadcast the tightness of who we think we are. And it doesn't matter how well adjusted we are. I mean, there are better ideas to be stuck on, but in all ideas that get fixed, there's some pain that follows. And practice is seeing that in ourselves. The practice of compassion is trying to relieve that in others, of not needing others to be anything. So we're moving along two parallel lines of healthy self and freedom from self. And healthy self actually looks a lot like freedom from self in some ways. You know, like when I think of self-esteem, sometimes people think like, oh, good self-esteem is I'm really good, you know, like I'm good, I'm a good person. Honestly, people who have a like healthy self-esteem, they're more like, I'm good, I'm bad, It's cool. You know? There's actually a looseness, like, oh, I fucked that up, yeah. I did great, okay, alright, you know? There's actually a looseness about it. It's not like, oh, yeah, I'm this or that. It's just less attached to views of self. And the insight into selflessness takes it one step further.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.